Okay. Bucham Aboyim, I would first of all like to dedicate the shiur to the Hatzlocha of Rabbi Moshe Polansky, who is today is undergoing a very, very difficult cross-examination. I'm sure Yitzhak Shem will come out Hatzlocha. Last time, we went through just about the entire of chapter 25, which is a pivotal chapter in the Rambam. And even though we raised a very, very, quite a number of issues and questions and investigations, tangential concepts, etc., 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 nonetheless, I think it would be worthwhile to perhaps review a little bit of the concepts that we came out with and to discuss them more in detail. As you will recall, there are very several important ideas in the Rambam, in Perek Hafei, which begins on page 341 of the Schwartz edition and goes to pages 342 and 343. Number one, the central idea of chapter 25 is that while the Torah for sure, the Torah's Moshe, according to the Rambam, is of the opinion that HaKadosh Baruch Hu created the world yesh bi'ayin, that means creation ex nihilo, creation of being from non-being, from absolute non-being. Nonetheless, the Rambam states explicitly here in chapter 25 that from a theological point of view, if a person believed in the Platonic version of eternity, that is to say that from an amorphous, formless, primordial matter, God fashioned the world, then such an opinion would rest with the other basic fundamental laws of Judaism, namely providence, chosenness, miracles, and so on and so forth. The theological problem that that stands in the way of our acceptance of the Aristotelian version of eternity is that since God is subject to the deterministic laws of nature, that in fact one cannot account for the chosenness either of individual people to be prophets or miracles or of the Jewish people or of specific laws and so on and so forth. In other words, the theology of the Torah would have to be radically revised, so much so that the Rambam says that in fact the Torah would, as we understand it, be all for the matter nullified, even though the Rambam does say that were Aristotelian eternity to be proven, we could certainly read the verses accordingly, but nonetheless, the Rambam's opinion is, at the very end of chapter 25, HaTera Kula Haisa Mizbatelis, the Tera would be completely nullified. On the other hand, though, with the theory of Plato's theory of the universe, we can maintain all the other fundamental axioms of Judaism, namely providence, the will of God in determining the chosenness of the Jewish people, the chosenness of his prophets, the particular positions and details which are taken on by nature, etc., etc. So in fact, in the very, very last paragraph of chapter 25, the Rambam says, because of the questions that we would have to ask, namely, why did HaKadosh Baruch Hu give prophecy to one person or another? Why did HaKadosh Baruch Hu give the Torah to one nation over another? Why did HaKadosh Baruch Hu give these certain mitzvahs as opposed to other mitzvahs? Right? Because of this, says the Rambam, we do not wish to accept the opinion of Aristotle as the attorney of the world, and therefore, says the Rambam, if in fact actually creation ex nihilo was proven, or even the eternity based upon Plato, we notice how now he places these two positions together, then in fact actually all the words of the philosophers of the Rambam would actually be nullified. This is the last paragraph on chapter 25. Right? Nonetheless, right? If in fact actually it will be proven that Aristotle's eternity is in fact the correct theory, so the Rambam has very strong language. The Torah will be nullified, and therefore because of this, we would have to, as Rambam says, we would have to accept other opinions, that's what the Rambam means by that. But it's clear that the Rambam understands that Plato's theory of the eternity of the universe is akin theologically to creation of Theolo, whereas on the other side of the fence is Aristotle's opinion of the eternity of the world. So we clearly from chapter 13 to chapter 25, the Rambam has basically grouped Plato with Moshe Rabbeinu, right, in one camp as opposed to Aristotle in the other camp. Now, what I'd like to do now is that now we've established this, that it's clear that one could believe in the eternity according to Plato. By the way, this happens to be the opinion of the Kuzari too, in the Maima Aleph, Perek, I think, section 66, 67, there the Kuzari says explicitly that one can believe in Plato's theory of eternity and still accept all the principles of Judaism. I think this is about the only thing that Rambam and the Kuzari actually agree upon. It's interesting that when everything is said and done, they agree upon this. But the question which I want to raise is that we have a, sort of a very, very funny there's a certain strangeness, and that is in such that, in other words, how could a person possibly believe in God and believe that the world coexists with God? Well, forget about Aristotle, even Plato. In other words, Plato says that God does not temporarily perceive, matter or the universe. Albeit the universe is in a different, form that we know now. But in other words, for sure, we intuitively think of God as a creator, which means that in a certain sense, God existed, or God, created the world, which means he existed before the creation of the world. According to Plato, we cannot say that God is, temporally perceives the universe, and that seems to me to be a little bit of a theological problem. The fact is that Rav Tzadik says explicitly in one of his, I forget what the name is, he has a Maimon on Kabbalah, and there Rav Tzadik says explicitly that the belief in Plato's eternity is actually minus. Because really what it is that a Kodesh Baruch Hu coexists eternally with the amorphous matter. And that somehow, in other words, that for sure runs against our inner intuitive notion of divinity, that ultimately there was but God, and God created the world. So in other words, the question I want to raise is how would the Rambam how would the Rambam accept such a theory that God is eternally coexistence with an amorphous matter? That seems to be the problem. In other words, I can understand. Look, if it was proven rigorously, then that's one thing. But in other words, our intuitions of God, becomes Baruch Hu, the divine, preclude his coexistence, his ultimate coexistence, with anything else but God. We are Hashem HaKadosh Mo'achad. Of course, Aristotle's, eternity is, we're not even thinking about that right now. According to the Rambam, the other principles of Judaism would be nullified. What I'm saying is, reading the Rambam, how are we supposed to understand that it is perfectly acceptable to believe that God eternally coexisted with something that is not God, namely the formless primordial matter? That's the question that I want to raise. Now,
Plato did it.
Okay, Plato's not a mind man.
He believes in God.
What?
He writes about God,
but look, that's true, but he writes about God, but I don't know. I don't know what Plato expected from God. But we certainly, we certainly expect just as much, probably more so. In other words, Plato might have posited that, you know, that God existed, you know, that the abstract, you know, the conceptual forms, you know, were contemporaneous with God. I don't know. I'm not sure. But I'm saying that, how would the Rambam understand this? How would, I mean, Rambam, you know, being an Orthodox Jew, how would he understand this? Now, first of all, and what's interesting is, that in fact, in the Mishnah Torah, in the Mishnah Torah, there's no mention of B'riyesh Me'ayin. That's Taka B'Pela. In Yosefiyah Torah, the phrase B'riyesh Me'ayin doesn't appear. In Hilchos Tshuva and Perek Gimel, when the Rambam lists all the many Apikosim, he doesn't list someone who believes HaKadosh Baruch Hu is not Katnoi. He doesn't list that at all. And actually, if a person just makes a perusal of Parakim Beis and Gimel in Yosefiyah Torah, there's nothing there to suggest anything other than Aristotle's theory of eternity.
It has to be like that, because once he said that if Aristotle were proven to be true,
I can't say that, but it wasn't.
It can't be an anchor. It can't be.
I understand that. But in other words, I understand that. But right, you know, he didn't want to write a Mishnah Torah that eventually 10 years later would be suddenly out of date. Okay, fine. But you know, besides that fact, I mean, how would we accept it like this? Now, first of all, so there's several answers which I want to, and that's really what I want to speak today. There's several answers which I want to perhaps suggest. First of all, it could be that the Rambam really held that all these theories of creation, I wouldn't say that they are under the category of the Mishnah, that whoever asked what was the form was after, it's better they should not have been born, but the Rambam felt that they're not central Judaism. In other words, just like, in fact, actually we saw in Aristotle and Plato, the things of creation also weren't central social Judaism, so not in Aristotle. In other words, for the Rambam, what's essential in Judaism is the halacha. And what's essential in halacha is that man be granted free will. In other words, Judaism is not a religion that's per se really interested in creation. Yeah.
We're also assuming that, I mean, the assumption that a lot of people have at the end of the Rambam is that the Rambam actually didn't believe that the truth of God is Plato's model.
So even more so. But the question is why, you know what?
I'm not saying that that's not necessarily the case. Ultimately, the Rambam.
No, even if the Rambam. In other words, the Rambam might have believed that scientifically. In other words, we have to go with Plato.
Well, actually.
Right, but the fact is that, in other words, what do I require? In other words, the question is, what's called a sufficient theory? In other words, of creation, which would guarantee the principles of Judaism. The answer is any theory of creation, right, that would guarantee man's free will and God's free will. In other words, given the fact that I guarantee God's free will and man's free will, so Plato's theory of eternity serves that. In other words, it could possibly be that there is no mitzvah in the Torah. There is no mitzvah in the Torah that commands me on one theory versus another theory. I have to believe in the existence of God. Right? Now, I have to believe in God as Kadmon, but Kadmon can mean anything. It could mean either temporally Kadmon or ontologically Kadmon. In other words, what's essential in Judaism, right, is the Bechir of Klal Yisrael, Batan Torah, the mitzvahs. That's essential in Judaism, man's free will. Right? Given that that's what's central in Judaism, right, cosmological speculation, right? In other words, is irrelevant, right? As long as it meets the principles which grant both God free will and ability to do miracles, and therefore consequently the free will of man. In other words, the Rambam might not have held that cosmology was an essential, or any specific cosmology, was basically, you know, a central part of Jewish belief. It's just that the Rambam held that I need a what you call a minimal cosmology that would guarantee what in fact actually, you know, is required, right, given the revelation of Sinai, and that would be a cosmology which in fact guarantee God's free will, miracles, the chosenness of the Jewish people, chosenness of the prophets, etc., etc. So in other words, that you should know something. And that's a little bit what the Kuzri argues. The Kuzri says, why should we waste time on all these speculative matters? It could possibly be that that's the pshat of the Mishnah, that whoever asked what was before, it's better they should not have been created. In other words, basically, a Kodesh Baruch Hu has, in other words, and Chazal, right, by limiting those people who learn Ma'aseh Bereishis, have decided that such speculation is off limits. We could never come to definitive answers. The main thing is that such speculation should not lead us to come up with natural principles which run counter to Torah and Mitzvah. So good ones in the Rambam not like that. That's number one. And you see that's really what he's saying in chapter 25.
The Rambam's saying that the Rambam held that Judaism therefore doesn't necessarily purport any kind of...
That's right.
...any kind of verity either way.
Right, right. In other words, what's important with Judaism is that God and man have free will.
And anything that's not important to Judaism, Judaism is addressing.
That could possibly be. In other words, and in fact, I mean, from an objective point of view, that could be the message of chapter 25. Lamai Nafkamina. Now, there would be a Nafkamina if we were, the only Nafkamina would be if in fact, Aristotle's theory of eternity would be true. Then we have problems. Then we have Tzoros. And the Rambam says, it's going to be both Batelos. But so long as Aristotle's theory is not proven, then, in other words, we can choose either between, Plato and Moshe Rabbeinu, and there's, that's what the Rambam is. Now, there is a, that's what I was saying offhand. That's one type of Tehillot. Now, the second type of a Tehillot, which I think is...
Why does Moshe Rabbeinu have an opinion?
I was just kind of thinking of addressing that, and I thought I'd move on to the next thing, but, let me go back to it. So Rabbi Sadi is asking a very good point. I mean, how could it be that Plato is about Plutus and Moshe Rabbeinu? I mean, right, there's a machlokes between Plato and Moshe Rabbeinu. Why is Plato about Plutus and Moshe Rabbeinu? How could Plato argue Moshe Rabbeinu? Now, you should know something.
That's how he articulates it. That on one end, he had
Moshe
Rabbeinu, and clearly Moshe Rabbeinu held free Yishmael.
Right, and Plato's arguing on it. And it could possibly be that Plato might be right, and I can hold either way.
No, but it's possible that Moshe Rabbeinu didn't necessarily.
The Rambam is claiming it. No, in the Rambam, the Rambam has not proved any proof that Moshe Rabbeinu held like that, except that maybe it's chapter 3, verse 1. But the fact is, the Rambam is making a machlokes Moshe Rabbeinu and Plato, and I can hold either way. But
so that's curious in itself. The Rambam could easily. Don't clearly said that we don't see anywhere that Moshe
Rabbeinu
didn't agree with
Plato. I know, but the Rambam understood that for whatever reason, which we actually we didn't really come to a final answer, Moshe Rabbeinu was of that opinion. In fact, it could be the following thing. It could possibly be like this. You're asking a question. Why something is about Plukta? I just want to tell you a story. I mean, I haven't told many stories in these 16 lectures, so I think today I got into a story mood. I was once we were once by a Hanukkah party. By the Zayda, Bianca. I was sitting there with my wife's grandfather, a bunch of Kamenetskis, I know the topic got onto science or something. So I asked my wife's grandfather, like, who knew more science? Einstein or Rabbi Akiva? So he said to me, Avada Einstein. What's the Shaila? I think some of the Kamenetskis were getting a little bit ruffled, I said, like, who knew more? And finally, I said, Einstein or I don't know, Yeshaya, whatever it is. But finally, at the very end, I said, he said, it's Dutzach Mia that Einstein knew more Torah, more science, except that maybe not Moshe Rabbeinu. As he said to me, not Moshe Rabbeinu. Then, of course, not to go to both of them upon him. So I understood from that. Pashtus is that Moshe Rabbeinu, and I mean the Rabban calls him Abba Chochma, that Moshe Rabbeinu somehow Chochma was now of course I was young and uneducated and I hadn't seen the Mod Nevuchim, at least I hadn't seen it in any great detail. Today was my grandfather was absolutely wrong on this. I'm not embarrassed to say this on the internet. My grandfather was absolutely wrong on this. First of all, we see that the Rambam clearly held Plato is about Plukta Moshe Rabbeinu, and I think really for the following reason, even Rav Tzadik says that the Arizal had Hasagas of Ohio Moshe Rabbeinu. In other words, Moshe Rabbeinu is greater than Nevi'a. Who says that Moshe Rabbeinu is the greatest for Chachamim? That's clear. He had reached the level of Chach when he came a Navi. But it's not clear. I'm not sure if the Rambam held that Moshe Rabbeinu was as big as Aristotle, as big as Plato. Because clearly it's about Pluto on them. It could possibly be that we could play prove Plato right or prove Aristotle right, but Shmuel was dead wrong.
Says it in chapter 48 of section 2. If Plato would have been a bigger chacham in physics, then Moshe Rabbeinu would be big enough. Moshe Rabbeinu, the reason he had his level of mavur is because of the level of
physics
and physical things.
I understand that, but on the other, he does say that because he said he brings the pasuk ani avir everything tuve right economic. But on the other hand, though, we see that in fact actually Plato is about Pluto Moshe Rabbeinu. In other words, the Rambam is emphasizing the Moshe Rabbeinu reached level of the world because of the level of chachma. But I mean, it's not so clear, at least from these prokem in creation, it's not clear that the Rambam held that just because Moshe Rabbeinu said something, it means that Plato Moshe Rabbeinu can't be wrong. He could be wrong and Plato could be right. What I want to Taina is, I always taina it, is that, in other words...
No.
So I want to taina, the Rambam says in several chapters after that, that since, scientifically speaking, there's a tie, a teiko, between creation ex nihilo and between eternity, so one opts for the nevuah Moshe Rabbeinu. It's mashma a little bit, that nevuah l'chud l'chachma l'chud. In other words, Moshe Rabbeinu's, Moshe Rabbeinu's, the Rambam clearly says that, Chachma evolves and develops as generations go on. We'll see in later chapters, after chapter 25, the Rambam even says that the astronomy of Chazal was not as accurate as the astronomy that, we're telling the Middle Ages of Ptolemy. But in other words, I want to claim that really the Rambam's position is that Plato and Aristotle and Solomon could be about Plato's and Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu was up there, that he could argue them. Moshe could argue on Plato. But in other words, Moshe Rabbeinu's nevuah, if it's chotech, if it's machriya the halacha, is not machriya beside the chachma of it. The Rambam says clearly that it is a tie between the two things. He says it actually twice in chapters. I think one is chapter 27, 29. And after that, a person goes with Maseiro, the nevuah of Moshe Rabbeinu. But the nevuah of Moshe Rabbeinu of itself doesn't raise that. That's why I said doesn't raise the chachma to a level where, it can, in other words, Rambam just probably held the prophecy and chachma in that sense, were two, incommensurable things. But what I want to say is, in other words,
in his discussion of the duo.
I understand it. From the pasuk called Tovi Lefanech, I understand that. But Lamaisa, I think Gary's trying to emphasize that Moshe Rabbeinu's Chochmah was up there. But in other words, it could possibly be that, there could be Hachwar and Chochmah. And the common sense, over here, that the attorney could be proven. If the attorney was proven, Moshe Rabbeinu was out. That's it. The Rambam didn't consider that it was impossible to disprove Moshe Rabbeinu, and I think that's
it could be a chiluk between Moshe Rabbeinu and Torah's Moshe Rabbeinu. It could be that Moshe Rabbeinu knew more than Plato, but what is written in the Torah is about
the. I don't think so, because if Moshe Rabbeinu pointed out clearly on the Torah Briyesh Miayin, then
Well, the Torah is not chad mashma'i one way or the other.
And well, according to the Rambam, it is. I mean, let's kick the Rambam.
It's not. According to Rambam, it's not, because you could dash them psukim allegorically.
That's if it was proven scientifically.
Exactly. Therefore, Torah's Moshe Rabbeinu is not Chad Mashmai.
Okay, fine. I would just say.
He still refers to something as what's called the Shita Moshe Rabbeinu.
I think the Rambam is.
If Moshe Rabbeinu was standing next to Plato, it could be Moshe Rabbeinu. The mice would know. We have to figure out what Moshe meant.
I don't know. The Rambam says clearly in Perek Yud Gimel that the sheet of Teres Moshe is that the world was created ex nihilo. However, the Rambam says it could possibly be that Tzara could be proven. So what? But in the Rambam it seems to be clear too, and also the sections of the Nevuah, that the Rambam gives a very clear distinction between the mitzvahs of the Torah and the non legal part of the Torah. In other words, it might be the Torah is like any Nevuah. In other words, not subject to certainty. Masha'enke and the mitzvahs are. Okay, this is a longer discussion. All I'm saying is, I would say that, in other words, I would take the position that I'm held in areas other than halacha, even though Moshe Rabbeinu certainly was at a level of chachma for which he was worthy of receiving the Torah, nonetheless, this does not grant Moshe Rabbeinu an ultimate certitude over that of Plato or Aristotle, and that in fact in future generations, the Rambam did not believe in Yiddish HaDeiros when it comes to chachma, a person can come along and prove rigorously in either of the eternity theories of Plato and Aristotle, and therefore Moshe Rabbeinu was out. That's it. But it doesn't in any way nullify his nevuah. Because the Ikar Nevuah Moshe Rabbeinu is coming to tell us mitzvahs. And the Rambam makes that very clearly in his section of prophecy. By the way, Derech Agav, now that I'm getting Dulshe, The Gemara says there's a Gemara in Brachas, I think it's Davot of Zion. There's a famous deal of Moshe Rabbeinu between Rabbi Meir and I think someone else there. The Gemara says that one says that Peschus three things, Moshe Rabbeinu was echad to the Nevuah. And then there's another opinion that says Pum Fakert. That when you wanted to, what I wanted to show you, you didn't want to see. Therefore, when you wanted, I didn't want to show you. Right? Upliga Rabbi Meir. So one of Taina is not a Machlaikas. One is speaking about Chachma, and one is speaking about Torah. In other words, in Torah, right, in another Moshe Rabbeinu gave him his Aspekla Be'ira, and that was the problem upon him. But in Chachma, Moshe Rabbeinu first turned away, because the Gemara didn't want to show it to him. That's Leisucha Lerosas Panai. So Kabasli V, there's no Machlaikas Rabbi Meir. And the other Tanaic opinion there, one is speaking about Torah, one is about Chachma. I always bring that Gemara as a riot to the Psadik, right? But here I'm bringing a riot to the Rambam. That basically, that in other words, Moshe Rabbeinu was off of Chachma, but Kodesh Baruch Hu said, Lo Suchu L'Rosas Panai, was saying that I'm not going to Avi Kol Tuvi L'Fanecha. That's what you're referring to. In other words, I will show you Chachma, the ultimate Chachma. I'm not going to show you. Meaning that what? I don't ask me about politics of yours, but in halacha, about halacha is like you. It's part of the problem. Yeah. Fine, but it doesn't.
He's called,
he understands, but once again, you know, we see clearly that, you know, the China can be proven. In other words, he's definitely in the Fortune 400, whatever it is. You know, he's up there. He gets a field prize. But in other words, okay, anyway, in any case, like this. Now, I want to go back to the question I was asking, which is another, you have something for me?
Yeah,
the Gemara in Brachos, yeah. No, it's, Dav Zayin Amud Aleph, I'm sorry. Not Vav Dav Zayin Amud Aleph in Brachos. Very good. Okay, fine. Now, but I want to go back to the original question, the question back. In other words, how could it be that theologically we can countenance, in other words, even if we say it's true, but how could it be that theologically we can countenance a world which was contemporary and coexistent with God until eternity? Now, I remember a few months ago, someone coming to the yeshiva at night, and he was a little bit upset over an article in Mishimu, where I think Rabbi Sedley suggested that the Gro learned the Tzimtzum Kipyutai. So he told me that can't be. That can't be. How can that be? I mean, how can it be that God leads the physical world? In other words, this was an intelligent person. I mean, he says, how can it be that God leads the physical world? It was a Bergman, right? So I said to him, I mean, what does it bother you? I mean, the Rambam, I mean, immanence is a recent addition to the Jewish philosophical lexicon. In fact, actually, I mean, before the Ari, I mean, the Rambam, there was no Havamina that God was launched in the physical world. So I was thinking that, in other words, just like this Jew understood intuitively, there must be that everything is Eibishter, except that he hides himself. How can it be that this part of the world, that the Kodesh Baruch Hu doesn't exist in any part of the world? So if you accept that, right, why I can accept the fact that the world coexists with God. In other words, once I understand that this part of the world that's physically separate from God, this part of the world is not Eibishter, right? So the Bainaf Kamina, if it's, you know, in space or in time. In other words, the Bala Tanya Taka screams out. He heard there's a Yid. And of course, he's referring to the Gor. There's no question about it. He heard there's a Yid who learns the Siddur Kipshutai, Chas V'Shalom, and then he brings the Besht. But the fact is that it's not clear at all that the theological difficulty of coping with a coexistent eternal matter with God is any different than coping with the fact that part of the world is separate from God. In other words, if I'm willing to accept the fact that God does not intrude on a major part of the physical world, there's nothing, you know, there shouldn't be anything that should bother me, that if God, you know, never intruded on this. I mean, and this is actually, in fact, you know, the critical question that we have to ask, because in fact, naturally, in other words, I mean, with the 16th century, I think we've spoken about this, You know, the Arizal makes, or certainly the interpreter of the Arizal understands, the Arizal made this incredible shift in paradigm that, you know, Kosh Boch was imminent. I think we spoke about this book about Descartes, et cetera, Malebranche, the Enlightenment. I mean, the fact is that for centuries before that, no one ever blinked when there was, you know, it was clear to every person, every religious person, whether it was Jewish, Christian, or Islam, or Muslim, that in fact, you know, God basically was not contained in the physical world. So in other words, somehow we have to understand that the medieval mentality was, they did not see difficulty in believing that the physical world was devoid of any divine presence. I mean, that's not a problem. In other words, for the Rambam, wasn't it? So take the Turner too. In other words, as long as God moves the world, who cares if he's coexistent with something that's not part of him? In other words, the medieval philosophers didn't feel that the world being part of God, about being part of the world, encompassing the world, right, was theologically necessary. So, yeah.
Doesn't Rambam say in Chelek that there can't be another God because that would limit?
Another God like God. There can't be another God who creates like God. But there could be another.
If there's laws of nature, if there's some kind of matter.
You see, you understand the same thing. In other words, what happens in the 15th century is that God is not a creator, God becomes a metzias. Because essential reality. In other words, look at the way the medieval philosophers like the Rambam and other people speak about providence, and look at the way the Ari speaks about providence. Providence for the Rambam is basically, you know, a response to my free will. Providence for the post-Ari and Hasidic masters was basically, you know, that the world is Epishta. In other words, providence has nothing to do with God punishing me or rewarding me. Providence has to do with basically, is what I'm doing part of God, not part of God. In other words, providence becomes basically a sub category of the Tzimtzum. In other words, the Tzimtzum means that everything is full of the Ein Sof. That's what's called providence. Everything is God. God is not some guy who's infinitely out there who's rewarding and punishing, like the Rambam understands. Providence means is that basically, like, you know, the Ein Sof is in every part of the world, and that's called providence. God, providence is God's imminence in the physical world. No, so in other words, what?
I don't understand.
In other words, what's providence or episodic? That everything's God.
Yeah, I understand. I don't understand how God can coexist with the world. I don't understand.
How God can what?
I don't see how you've answered the question. I don't understand.
No, what I'm saying is there's a radical change in the concept of God. In other words, for the medieval philosophers, God is basically just, you know, God is basically punishing or rewarding people, or he's moving the world. He stands outside the world, is controlling the world. In other words, the medieval philosophers understood God not as a being who encompasses all of reality. He's basically a being who's in control. He's a king. He's in control of reality. But he's not, in other words, he punishes and rewards. But in other words, he's not, the fact that God is responsible for all existence, for metzios, is not because he encompasses metzias. It's because, you know, he rules, or he decrees that things should exist. He has the power of life and death. He's a judge. He's a melech. He's a king. He's not what's called a mekayem mishal olam. Now there's a radical change. In other words, our inability to understand how the Rambam could have possibly understood that God coexists eternally with some other matter, I mean, could possibly be just part of a major crisis that we have when people refer to Rishonim. You know, but the fact is that somehow the concept of God for the Rambam was different. The Rambam's concept of God has really absolutely nothing to do with our concept of God. Even though we believe in Yud Gimel Ikra, we believe it with the twists and turns that, you know, that took place over the last 300-400 years.
Would the Gra or the Yosha Levav
agree? So the Yosha Levav and the Gra are probably, you know, Gilgulim of the Rambam post Arizal.
They would hold that the world could have coexisted?
No, you see, the Goyim probably, yeah, but the Goyim establishes this irreducible economy, God of itself, God, in other words, they're moed the mitzvahs. In other words, they believe that God doesn't enter the world, but that's not a problematic because it's only one aspect of God. In other words, there's an aspect of God that's separate from that, so we can't say that God is restricted because that's only part of the divine picture. That's the way they would answer. In other words, I think that the ultimate answer to how can it be that the world devoid of God is because that's not the only picture of God. There's a God in and of himself which I don't speak about. It could possibly be that somehow God makes up for that some other way. How he does, I have absolutely no idea, but it's not important. In other words, the fact that there's a God in and of himself, independent of the way it relates to us, just means that I can never get 100% certainty, you know, or, you know, be makif the question. So therefore, it shouldn't be a theological crisis for me because I have limited knowledge as it is. That's how I understand really the answer. But in other words, I'm saying, you know, the answer to this question is no different than, you know, the Rambam's rationalist medieval time philosophy is something which is very strange to us. It doesn't somehow meet with our ordinary notions of reality and God, etc., etc. It's just different from us. You know, the Rambam didn't feel that was a problem. It didn't limit God in any way. And by the way, Derech Agav, you should know. I mean, this is really one of. I mean, we spoke about in the Shira in chapter 13. You know, Descartes, the discovery of mathematical principles that govern the terrestrial as well as the celestial world, and the emergence of immanence in a scientific sense, and then ultimately the theological divine sense. But, you know, as to ultimately why these things occur, we don't understand. We don't know. I mean, it's just that, in other words, I mean, the Ramchal would just say it's called the Gilui Yehuda. In other words, basically, the world is constantly emerging, where there's a, you know, more things become God in history. In other words, more things become God in history. That's maybe one way to explain it. I don't know. But all I'm saying is I'm reducing this question to another question. When you give me an answer on the first question, I'll be answering the second question for you. That's what I'm saying. I want to... I think there's another point which I wanted to... The fact is that the Rambam... Para 25 is a pivotal parak. You know, in other words, at the end, Rambam really, gives his conclusion. But I want to go back to an important point that we spoke about. Now, I think in the very, very first class, I raised the issue that there are places in the Rambam where the Rambam, it is suggested in the Rambam that the Rambam's true theory was that of eternity. And I think I certainly brought up one Maramakim, which appears actually in Parak Lamed Beis, in the first chapter of the Rambam section of prophecy, of Nevuah. And I want to go back to that because I think that this is going to highlight the very interesting, how we could really sort of like tie things together and come to a more cohesive and encompassing understanding of the Rambam's theory here. The Rambam, at the beginning of chapter 32, says that there are three opinions regarding prophecy. One opinion is... section 2. It's actually page 373 in the Schwartz edition. There the Rambam says that there are three opinions of prophecy. One opinion is that prophecy can be given to anyone. In other words, any bor ama oretz, mushchas, a person who has absolutely no mental and moral capabilities and virtues, Kosh Bocha can make him into a prophet. The Rambam rejects that completely. The second theory of prophecy is that prophecy is a natural talent, that a person does not need what's called siyata nishmaya, doesn't need any divine assistance. Once a person achieves a certain level of wisdom and knowledge and moral perfection, then prophecy follows automatically. And the third opinion of prophecy, according to the Rambam, is that even that a person certainly needs certain requirements, like knowledge, wisdom, and moral perfection, but without any some type of divine assistance, Siyata D'Shmaya, right, then the person will not necessarily be able to prophesize. Now, the Rambam, as you recall, and I mentioned this, makes a very enigmatic statement when he says that the three theories of prophecy correspond to the three theories of creation. The Rambam says that the Shita of Teras Moshe is the third theory, which means that a person, while he required that he have a certain that he have, you know, the requirements, nonetheless, he requires Siyata D'Shmaya. Now, when I look at the three, if I line them up, it comes out, it seems to be a very simple thing. The opinion that I can take any born Abba Olaf into a prophet, that corresponds to Bria Yishmiyayin. The fact that prophecy is natural doesn't require any, you know, decision, you know, of based upon a Kodesh Baruch Hu, corresponds to the Aristotelian concept of eternity. So it would follow that what the Rambam seems to be saying in secret is that my Shita is the Shita of Plato's eternity. In other words, that we start off with a certain talent, with a certain a potential, and with the prophet Siyata D'Shmaya, because both can allow this talent to develop and become a prophet. So, in other words, we have there an interesting thing. The Rambam seems to be suggesting that the real Shita of the Torah is that of Plato's turn of the universe, which of course would be an incredible stira to everything we've learned, especially to chapter 13, where the Rambam said the Shita of Teres Moshe Rabbeinu was Briyash Miayin. So I want to answer that by saying the following thing. The Rambam at the end of chapter 30, we've spoken about that. I mean, the minds of these 16 children, we've come to the conclusion that for the Rambam, we don't have competing theories, but rather we have, in other words, two different visions of the man-God relationship, or basically, in other words, man looks at God as the creator, and then man looks at God as the source of his free will. You know, the concept of nothingness. We've spoken about this in detail. Now, the fact is that in chapter 13, the Rambam is speaking about creation in and of itself. It's speaking about free will. In other words, from chapter 25, right, from chapter 25, we see that the Rambam, in other words, is speaking about creation, but also free will. Right? Free will ultimately derives, I mean, even though, I mean, Plato's theory of the eternal universe satisfies the requirements, certainly the spitz, the ultimate form of free will is derived from what's called Bria Yesh Miayin, creation ex nihilo. But you see, in chapter 32, the Rambam is speaking about prophecy. Prophecy is a man-God relationship. Now, if you look in my article on negative theology, in the first volume of Rishimu, you will see that I think I clearly demonstrate that just like there's a physical creation which man observes, analyzes, and attributes to God, there's also what's called a spiritual creation, which are the thoughts of God, which the Navi describes these thoughts of God, and I use this argument in explaining how the Rambam was able to relate to Jewish liturgy. In other words, prophecy is basically spiritual science. In other words, just like the scientist looks at the physical world and studies it rationally, right? So too, the prophet, you know, somehow picks up the thoughts of God and describes them, and that becomes, you know, nevuah, text, scripture, you know, or liturgy of the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah. So I wanted to say that what the Rambam is saying, I think, is the following thing. In chapter 32, the Rambam is saying, what is the theory of the creation of the world?
That assumes that the metaphysics that a scientist is concerned with and the metaphysics that a prophet is concerned with are two different things.
They're two different things, but they're parallel. In my article, the physics of right. In other words, they have parallels. Just like, for example, when a person contemplates the scientific beauty of the world, he's drawn to a love of God. So too, when a person contemplates the words of the liturgy of the tefillah, which come from the Gedolah, which come from the Rambam, are rooted in the Vua, a person is filled with a love of God too. In other words, the Rambam, in my article, was drawing a clear parallelism between the two things. So what I wanted to say is...
The question is that according to the Rambam, the progression that creates these thoughts that the prophet can...
That's a creation.
But those thoughts themselves end up spilling over and creating
the
physical.
And but the prophet picks them up before they come to physicality. In other words, the prophet picks up the thoughts of God. In other words, afterwards they come to the act of intellect, the celestial spheres, etc. But the prophet is able to pick them up metaphysically, in the metaphysical stage. In other words, the prophet is basically a holy scientist. So, what I want to say is that in the Rambam in Nevoah, the Rambam is saying, what is the theory of creation of the world, which is the most commensurable with man's, in other words, man is a, from man's like scientific outlook on things, because a prophet is like type of a medical scientist. And the Rambam will say, that's the theory of the world. In other words, the Rambam in prophecy is speaking about creation vis-a-vis, not from the concept of freedom of creation ex nihilo, but from the concept of a world which man studies and, you know, man analyzes. So in other words, if the truth of the Rambam, which I've been claiming over these lectures, is that really there are two theories of creation. There's creation ex nihilo, and there's which guarantees man's freedom, and then there's creation, which guarantees, you know, a world which man can study, which has natural law. So we would expect that the theory of creation corresponding to prophecy, which prophecy itself is a form of science, right, would be a theory of eternity. Wouldn't it be a theory of absolute creation ex nihilo? Because absolute creation ex nihilo, basically, is just that which is behind free will. But man's ability to comprehend the world, man's analysis of the world, in a metaphysical sense, right, comes from the fact that the world's eternal and has natural law. Except in the case of prophecy, we're not speaking about natural or metaphysical law, but the two things are parallel. So in other words, what the Rambam says in chapter 32 and implies chapter 2 is not a seat in chapter 13. Chapter 32, the Rambam is speaking about the prophet as a scientist. Just like the scientist raised the world in terms of Aristotelian eternity, let's say. So the prophet raised the world in terms of Platonic eternity. The thoughts of God. That's Platonic. But creation ex nihilo, which is the source of free will, right, can be what it is, and there's not necessarily a contradiction between the two. That's what I want to say is the resolution of this thing. Okay, in any case, I think with this statement, that's more or less all really I want to say about creation ex nihilo up till chapter 25.
So creation ex nihilo is something that the Rambam that accounts for one parallel of reality according to the Rambam.
Right, and that's the concept of nothingness of free will.
But that's not the reality of either prophecy or science.
No, two different realities. It's interesting that
Does that mean that if we believe in creation ex nihilo by Moshe Rabbeinu, then we would not be able to have laws of science?
No, because Moshe Rabbeinu might have believed in both of them too.
So we would not discover, or the laws of science would be an illusion.
No, they aren't. It's a different reality. When I'm doing science, I'm doing science.
So even Moshe Rabbeinu believed in Plato?
It might be. I mean, ultimately, a libidamus.
Or a libid of science.
Right, whatever it is. Libidamus. Derech Agav, you should know something. That might be the pshat in chapter 48. When Moshe Rabbeinu was starting the Bria, he was being a Aristotelian.
And that's why Plato's about Moshe Rabbeinu, because really it's both Moshe
Rabbeinu. Right, economy, right. And that's what the ultimate answer. Really, that they're speaking about different things. Moshe Rabbeinu's a Navi and Plato's a scientist. Moshe Rabbeinu can agree with them. In principle, the way I'm looking at the Rambam. I think this is a very, very rational reconciliation of the Rambam. I've been giving a summer series on Yigibel Ikrim, and I think I said this something like a synopsis of this. I came to the fourth ikur, that's Bria Shmiayin, and some girls complained they couldn't daven mincha after the class. So I said, they had to say Ashrei, first of all. Ashrei Yesh Mifik Zavcha. Settle your mind. So, anyway, I think with this, basically, we will end lecture 16. I want to just sort of like, it'll give it like upcoming attractions. Since we are in an undisclosed location and undisclosed time, But
it's the same day as Moshe.
Right, right. But we But since I told you it was Moshe Polanski's cross examination, so therefore, because of this, we're gonna have to rush things a little bit. Now, it is true that chapters 26, 27, 29 are very interesting chapters, important chapters. There is speaks about Chazals and Pesukim, etc., etc. But the full import of the Rambam's understanding of Ma'aseh Bereishis comes really in chapter 30. Chapter 30 is almost connected kula. It's a kolbay, and therefore there the Rambam actually goes through the first few pockets of Bereishis and basically addresses them on all levels of interpretation, pshat, remish, tumish, and sa'id. And I think probably what we'll do is we'll skip over to chapter 30, because we only have like about five shiurim left. And I think for purposes of, let's say, you know, completion, at least the illusion of completion, that we could we'll try to, you know, address the major issues of chapter 30, where the Rambam speaks about everything. He speaks about he really learns pshat and psukim and bereishis, etc., etc. And I think that I think the next class will be actually begin chapter 30. Are we finished? Until then, in other words, this concludes actually everything about creation that you ever wanted to know. I'm afraid to ask from chapter 30 and chapter 25. There is chapter 30. There is, by the way, chapter 12, which we have to get to eventually. Not now. I guess when we speak about negative theology or whatever it is. So in any case, until then, I wish everybody a tzlacha rabba. And until next time.